World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. When the Anzac Centenary Memorial Walk was opened in Adelaide in April 2016, Bill Coorey cut the ribbon, flanked by the state premier and the state governor. Not long afterwards, in August the following year, this public-spirited rat of Tobruk joined the governor for another ceremony, this time to celebrate Bill's own 100th birthday with morning tea and cake at Government House.
I was born at Riverton, lived at Tarlee. Both of my families were pioneer families. And being just on 100 years old, I consider that I'm probably the oldest connection to South Australia that there is.
You say pioneers. Your family, your ancestry, goes back a long way in South Australian history.
1837. And on Dad's side, 1838.
So on your mother's side, 1837.
Yes.
And do you know what ship they came out on?
My great-grandmother's name was Marion Baird, and she came out as a young girl, 13. She had brothers and sisters, and also her mother had married again, and she had some children, and their name was Greg.
So they lived, they farmed at Riverton, did they?
No. Marion married William Coulthard that came out on the Buffalo.
Yes, C-O-A-L...
C-O-U-L-T-H-A-R-D.
Coulthard, yes, yes. Okay.
He and they settled at New Ripton.
Right.
That's the original home up there.
I can see a picture on the wall above, Bill, of the old family homestead, a couple of horses and drays outside.
Oh, that is on my father's side.
Right.
Mother's side is that it's an historic home at New Ripta, Coulthard Memorial.
Yes, I can see that photograph as well. And the whole family group outside there.
Yes.
So what did they do there, Bill?
Well, my father's side, my great-grandmother there was... her name was Watson. They were the ones that came out in 1838. She married Henry Coorey, who came over from Victoria to the borough, and he was a tailor. They married, and when the mines closed there, everyone went over to Wallaroo, and he went over there and opened a business at Kadena. But he died young, 35. So in those days, when a woman was left with children, there wasn't all the social services. Today they married again, and she went back to the borough when her husband died, and there she met John Roberts.
Right.
He had... his wife had died, and he had several, I think about four girls. Anyway, they married, and they went out to the farming area and opened a store, which people, and a post office, but people used to post letters to Roberts Town.
Yep.
It didn't have a name.
Right.
But Roberts Town became the name of the town, Robertstown. Now, my grandfather, I believe he was about 17 at this time, he started a butcher's business at Robertstown.
Right. Butchery, of course, and became very important to you.
And that came down to had a butcher's business on Glen Osmond Road. Mm.
All right. Now, from Robertstown, what is the connection with Riverton, though? How did that...
Well, he came to Hamley Bridge to work. He left home and went to my father. This is my father.
Yep.
And at that time, my grandmother, when I say my great-grandmother, William Colthart, he died exploring up north. And he never left a will.
He just died of exposure or no water or something?
No water.
Yeah, yeah.
Natives found him.
Really?
And so there was she with eight children.
Yeah.
This big home at the... Then it was a big home, you know. And the boy was left the farming business, and quite an extensive farming business, I think. At that time, a man named Philip Patterson came out with the Angus family, and he was an expert with Angus cattle.
Yes.
And not Angus.
Sure.
A lot of people get mixed up with that, but Angus cattle is a different, nothing to do with Angus. And he helped with looking after the property. And then he married Marion. And they had three more children. And my grandmother was one of those extra three children, you see.
Now, the man who died exploring, that was your grandfather?
No, he wasn't actually, he was my great-grandmother's husband.
Great-grandmother's husband, right.
But, yeah. You see, I'm related to all the Colthards in that half lot.
Where was he found? He went along
north of Lake Eyre.
Good God.
And yeah. I believe the grave is still there.
Yes, what a terrible death.
Yes, must have been. Awesome. His horse, I think he'd cut the horse's throat.
Yeah, drink the blood, yeah.
And, but...
I remember reading an account in a newspaper from those days about an explorer who left a message, a final message, scratched on a tin. Was it him?
That's him.
That was in the very early edition of the Adelaide Advertiser.
That's right.
Terrible story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is William Colthart.
Right. So...
And last Sunday week, I went down to Port Elliot to my last surviving one of that era.
Yeah.
Nada England, her name was. She was Nada Colthart.
Yes.
And she was my first cousin.
Right. Yeah.
Because my mother's sister actually married her cousin. so she was my first and second cousin.
How do you spell Nada?
N-A-I-D-A.
So now we've got to the stage of your father.
Yes.
And he was a butcher?
Yes, at Hamley Bridge.
At Hamley Bridge.
Now, the Pattersons, when that young Colthard turned 21, then the Pattersons and the three youngest Colthards, they moved to Hamley Bridge.
Yep.
And from Hamley Bridge, they went up north to Bullaroo.
Yep.
What is called Bullaroo Centre now, but it was just called Bullaroo. And the Pattersons were set up on the farm, and Tom Colthart was set up on the farm there. There are no one at Bullaroo today.
Yeah.
But my mother was born at Bullaroo in 1880.
I better get your parents' first name. So your dad's name was?
Arthur. Thomas Arthur.
Thomas Arthur?
Always known as Arthur.
Thank you. And your mother?
My mother was Muriel Warren Miller.
So Muriel is her given name. Warren was another middle,
yes,
middle name. And Miller.
Miller.
M-I-L-L-E-R?
Yes.
Thank you.
The Millers come from Turriepta.
Right.
From Truro. Yeah, I get it.
That's all right.
Truro.
Yeah, okay.
And they had set their eldest son up on a farm at Bullaroo Tea, you see.
That's
it right. Was all new country, open, original owners up there.
So Dad was a butcher.
And he had, yes, well, this Miller, James Miller, he had four daughters. Grandma, great-grandma, Marion, thought it was too much for her daughter to look after. So she took my mother, who was the eldest, and my Auntie Jean, who was the youngest, and looked after them. But they lived at Hamley Bridge then,
yep,
you see. And that was where my mother was when she met my father,
and
at Hamley Bridge.
Right. Now, your father didn't do military service, World War One.
No, no.
There was no conscription then.
No, and he was, you know, in the upper 30s with,
yes,
children.
So what year was he born, do you know?
1882.
1882, yeah.
And he was born at Robertson.
Oh, he was in his 40s by the time war broke out, yeah.
He was long born while ago.
He was born at Robertstown.
Yes.
And your mum, she was born
at Bullaroo.
And do you know the year?
1880.
1880, good. So you came along, and they're married when? What year?
1907.
Thank you. So where do you figure in the family?
I was the youngest of four boys.
Yep.
I had an elder sister who was 10 years older than me.
Right.
And I had a younger sister who was 18 months younger. But I had three brothers and they were all tall fellas.
Yes. Yes.
And of course I'm not tall. So I've had to battle tall people all my life. Taller and older.
Yeah.
And I always say it's so much easier for tall people in this world. They just have that presence that they, but a small fella can still get there, but he's got to work twice as hard.
All right. So in a sense, you're 100, but you feel you're 200. So I got you. So you were the youngest of all the children. There were six of you altogether.
Yeah, no, my daughter, I had a sister.
Thank you. An elder sister and three brothers, yeah, and a younger sister.
Now, my elder sister married, he was classed as a returned soldier because he was on the way to the war.
Yep.
When the war finished.
Right.
And they turned around and came back.
Okay.
And I did have an uncle that was a lieutenant.
Yeah.
I don't know what unit he was in.
What are your very earliest memories?
Oh, I remember Talee very well.
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
I loved, because the country was born into me. I love the country.
Yeah.
And I get a thrill every time I go back to Talee or go through it, you know.
What was it in particular? Did you enjoy school? Did you enjoy sport? What was it?
I've enjoyed life, or all my life.
Yeah.
As a young boy, life was very simple back in the 1920s.
Sure.
You see, that's, I didn't know my grandparents because there was no travelling.
Yeah.
We didn't have motor cars to just hop in and run somewhere. So, no electricity.
Yeah.
The roads were only metal roads. And, you know, there was a few old tin Lizzies, as we used to call them.
That's right.
The old T-model Fords. And
what do you do for recreation? Do you ride a horse or go fishing?
We country, there was always a football team, yep. a cricket team, a tennis team. We didn't have toys because there was no toys around. Christmas time, we hung a stocking up and got a few boiled lollies in them. And we thought that was wonderful. But we always had a ball. And I think you'll find that just about all country children, they used to play with a ball from the time they're born, you know.
How'd you cool off in the very hot summers in those days?
I don't know. I know we had hot weather, but I've always liked hot weather.
Dad had a butcher's shop then, yes. right from the start.
Well, it belonged to his cousin.
Yeah.
Bert Roberts was a very well-known character at Riverton.
Right.
Dad managed a shop at Tarley, which was the butcher and the baker. But there was a baker there that right. used to do that. Another recreation that I used to catch yabbies.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
My brother next to me was 4 years older, so, you know, I had a lot to do with my next brother next to me. And, of course, being 4 years older, I was always chasing after him, and whatever we did, we caught yabbies down the creek,
yeah.
kerosene tin, petrol or kerosene lights. It was all come in 4 gallon tins.
Exactly.
Nothing was wasted in those days.
Yeah.
Everything was used, and they were the buckets.
Yeah.
So we'd catch the yabbies, make a fire, cook the yabbies, some vinegar, pepper and salt, and they can have all their fancy sauces today, but I go up to Corn. I've got a grandson lives at Corn, and he's always got some yabbies for me. And as I say, that vinegar and pepper and salt, and I love them.
Beautiful.
We also used to pick mushrooms by the bucket full of mushrooms. There was no fertilisers much in those days, and mushrooms used to grow like magic in the paddocks.
What do you remember of the atmosphere in the butcher's shop? The smell, the sawdust, the knives. What do you remember of that?
Well, in my business, yes. That's what it was.
But in your dad's business?
Dad's business mostly was delivering to the farms.
Yep.
There wasn't much of a shop, you know. It was really a depot.
Gotcha.
And he went... And a horse and cart,
yep.
A couple of wheat bags on the floor and a white sheet over the top of the meat. Nobody died, you know. When you think of the hygiene today, it's all...
Sure.
And also the bread, you see.
From
the bread and the meat was both carried in the old cart.
Did you accompany him on this?
Yes, I used to love going around on that. And I had a friend, Bob Clark, and I often used to stop out at Clark's, and he had a pony.
Yeah.
But I used to ride out there.
I was going to ask you about riding.
But of course I never rode or never went near the horses at home, because my mother had an uncle who was crippled. And I believe he was crippled through a kick from a horse.
So you were told to steer clear of them?
So, as far as she was concerned, I was supposed to keep away from horses.
Did you learn to ride bareback?
No, we used to have a saddle.
Yeah, good idea.
But, because they used to come into school in the sulky.
Yes, the sulky. Yeah.
And, you know, that the words just come out. But, you know, there was, I can't think of all the different names of the different things, but the sulky was one of them. And
What about school itself? You mentioned school then.
Yes.
You went to...
Tarley School.
Tarley.
Yes.
Tarley area, Tarley primary.
Primary.
Yep.
Grade 1 to grade 7, all in the same class room.
How many of you, do you
remember? On my memory, I'd say about 25 to 30 in the...
Chalk and slates? Is that how you did it?
Yes, chalk. And pencils, of course. One man teacher, Mr. Dawson, only had one arm, returned.
Yeah. Really?
First war.
Lost an arm in the war, yeah.
I had a lot to do with returned soldiers. Yeah. I grew up with their children and knew them, and when we moved down to Adelaide, I had a man next door. I had a man at the back. I had a man on the other side of the road who never lost his arm, but he never had any use of his arm. And I had a friend at school. This was grade 7. I was 10 years old when we came to Adelaide. The only part of our family that's ever lived in town have all been country people.
Right.
And... this, my friend, his father didn't come back.
Really?
Now, during the Second World War, when I was involved, I never really worried about getting killed. Now, that might sound odd, but I saw, you know, that we had about 250 killed in our unit, so I was quite used to people getting killed. And to me, that was the end. You didn't have any more worries. You didn't have anything. It was finished. But it was the people back home.
Sure.
And I was aware of this from when I was a boy, because I had this friend whose father didn't come back. And I used to think it was awful that his mother had to go out and do housework to earn a few shillings. And at that time, women didn't go out to work. They were home with children. So I always used to feel sorry if, just say, if Frank got killed, oh, hell, he's married and got a couple of kids or something.
Why did the family make the move to Adelaide?
Well, because my two eldest brothers, they got their intermediate at Riverton High School. They used to catch a train in the morning and come home at night. But, you know, there was trains going through all the time in those days. That wasn't any great problem. And Riverton was only... 6 miles or so away, but it was very unusual for young people like that to get their intermediate.
Exactly.
They did it at Riverton. Now, they were down in Adelaide boarding, and my mother thought, well, there's not much future in stopping in the country. The boys are in town. Ken and Bill are growing up, and so they made the move to Adelaide.
So this must have been a tremendous change for you.
Well, it wasn't such a big change, because Adelaide, I know interstate people laugh at Adelaide, it's still a big country town, but it was... there wasn't much difference. Adelaide was only a big country town.
So tell me what your father did down here.
Well, the Depression came.
Of course.
1930s, around there, you see. Well, it was 1927, I think, when we moved to Adelaide. And he had to go back to work for his cousin.
Yeah.
And he used to come home, not every weekend, but most... weekends.
So he'd go back to the country to work?
Yes.
Up in Tully?
At Riverton,
yeah. Mm. Okay.
Yeah. For his cousin, yeah.
And in the meantime, Mum looked after the family down here.
Mum looked after the family.
And where did you live here, Bill?
At Gilberton.
Gilberton. There's a long connection with Gilberton. I noticed that in your history.
Yes. Oh, well.
Did you swim in the river there?
Gilberton swimming pool.
I wondered about that.
Everyone knows of the Gilberton swimming pool. And it seems unbelievable, but they held an Australian championship at the Gilberton swimming pool in that dirty old... Well, it wasn't so dirty back in those days.
And the famous bridge, swing bridge.
And the swing bridge was... that was put there, and we used to really swing on it too.
I
know you wasn't supposed to, but as kids we'd get it. It was your turn to get in the middle, and it had a fair sag there.
Exactly.
So, and the ones both ends, they would get it rocking. And your feet would go up above the rails, you know. A bit dangerous.
Very dangerous.
But of course, when you're kids, that's adventure, isn't it?
Were you any good at swimming and diving?
I used to go in competitive swimming, handicap. I wasn't a champion, but I did win a trophy back, you know, with the... But as a handicap swimmer.
Sure. Well, freestyle, backstroke, what did you win it for?
Freestyle.
Okay. Mm. Well, where did you go to school then?
I went to Walkville School.
Walkville Primary?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I went to Adelaide High School.
Adelaide High.
Mm.
Right. When did you start taking interest in girls? What can you tell me about girls at school?
Well, I didn't take much interest in girls because... you know, I had a young sister. It was just about my age, you know, and I was used to girls, you know. When we moved to Adelaide, a few doors up from us was a family who were boating people, sailing. Medwell family. Stan Medwell was a noted swimmer, champion, you know, a state champion. And he asked me one day, do you want to come sailing? Oh, give it a go. He said, bailer boy. Well, he had an 18-footer. And there was half a dozen chaps sitting up on the top sides. And here was little Bill down the bottom, bailing the water out, and it was, you know, on windy days it would be more water coming in than I could bail out. And these chaps used to sling off at me and say, oh, you're frightened, you little so-and-so, you know. And I used to say, I'm not frightened. I could hardly speak. I was that frightened because I've never seen so much water in my life, you know. And one day we were going down to there's a port sailing club. We were going down the port road on motorbikes, you see, and I was on the back of a motorbike, and I suddenly thought, gee, I hope there's plenty of wind today. I'd always thought, I hope there's not much wind today. I hope there's plenty of wind today. And I never looked back, and I was sailing over a period of 50 years. I sailed with Norm Howard, who went in 11 Sydney Hobarts later on in his life. I sailed in cadet team, sharpies, 14-footers at Henley Sailing Club. Later on, I had my own yacht at the Yacht Squadron for 25 years.
That's terrific.
I was 65 when I finished.
Okay.
sailing. So I don't know whether you know about sailing, but people get very involved with sailing.
Yeah.
And I was more interested in sailing than girls. Now, when I come back from the war,
yeah,
5.5 years of living with men, not only living with men, but living in the conditions that we lived in. And then I came home from Borneo, because I was still going, and arrived in Adelaide by train. Got off the train in about 2 hours. I was out on the street, discharged, a civilian.
Yeah.
It's pretty a funny feeling, I tell you.
Dramatic shift. Yeah.
Oh, you know, there I was, 5.5 years, you know, doing as you're told and everything, and there you are, out in the street, you know. Anyway, I was pretty lost. It wasn't a very good time, really. And I met a young lady who I went to a dance at the Druids Hall at Walkerville. And I knew a girl there that went to school. She was a married woman then. And she said to me, "Would you walk home with Iris afterwards, because she's fairly nervous of walking?" I said, "Yeah, I'll walk home." And she lived at Broadview, and you thought nothing of walking that day. I walked up to Broadview and then had to walk back home to Gilberton afterwards. And I said, I walked home and said, "Oh, well, see you later." That was it. But I ran into her again. And that was the end of Bill. I didn't know, but when she went home that night, she said, "I've met him, I've met him." And I didn't know about this. But when a woman gets a...
I should just explain for people who are listening to this recording and actually aren't looking at Bill. Very handsome man with a magnificent head of hair. You've got good aquiline features, a fine jaw, very well set ears, and that superb hair. You obviously were a handsome young man, and people like this young lady would have been attracted to you.
Well, I've always got on easy with people.
Yep.
Somehow or other, I just seem to connect with people. And that was the turning point with meeting my future wife. That was the turning point in getting back to civilian life. We got engaged in a couple of months. She worked in the office of the Shell Company, and they used to have a ball every year at the Palais. And I... because I used to dance at the Palais, so I had a dinner suit and stiff dicky bow tie and everything. So we got engaged in a very romantic way. I said to her, "Well, we've got engaged, I suppose we might as well get married." I was married then for 61 years.
Yeah.
And she was a great wife, a great mother, and we never argued. I don't ever remember having an argument.
Thank you.
We had different opinions of things, but never arguments in my house. And I think the children, you know, grew up in that sort of atmosphere.
Sure.
And they've always been happy people too. So, people ask me about, "Well, how have you... got to be so old?" I say, "Well, don't be envious, be happy with what you've got, and that makes a big difference."
Now, you were at Adelaide High School.
Yes.
And how long did you stay there? What age did you leave?
Well, I did what we called the intermediate
right
in those days, and that was really like year 10, I think, today. But of course, lots of the lads never ever got to high school. They went to work from grade 7 for a few bob a week.
Yep.
You know, I think they got about 5 shillings a week, which is 50 cents.
But what was your ambition in terms of employment? What did you want to do?
I never thought. You know, we didn't, and especially being a country boy, I'd never thought of careers.
Yeah.
Like today, every young person they get, and they've got their thoughts on what they want to be, but I never had any thoughts on what I wanted to be. You just went to work.
So you left school? How old were you?
Well, I suppose I was about 16, I think. Yeah.
And you say you went to work. What did you do?
I had people next door owned a butcher shop. And they asked me, did I want a job? So that's where I started.
And that was in Gilberton?
That was in Gilberton.
What street was that?
That was in Gilbert Street. And I didn't stop there very long, and I was asked, would I like to work for them? As I say, I've never had to seek employment. The people have always asked me, and that's right through my life. I've only done, people ask me to do things, and I can't say no to anything. So that was in St. Peter's. And so I worked there then right up until I joined up.
So this was another butcher shop?
Another butcher shop.
And
it wasn't like working for a boss. I was part of the family.
Very nice. Tell me the name of these people.
Powell's.
P-O-W?
A-E Powell, it was.
P-O-W-E-L.
E-W.
And they owned the shop in St. Peter's?
Yes.
Mm. And were these other people had the one in Gilberton? Or was
yes.
Another one?
Yes.
So A-E Powell offered you a job, an apprentice butcher, were you?
Yes.
You learned the trade?
Yes. I didn't do any. In those days, you didn't go to any apprenticeship.
Right.
Business, you only just learnt what working in the place. You know.
Risky game, but you've got all your fingers, I see.
I've got all my fingers, got everything. It was a bit like still living in the country. Just working, I knew all the people, everyone knew me, and I've always got on well with people for some reason or other. I was there until I joined up.
So you were, by then, you were 22 years of age.
22.
Yeah.
I had my 23rd birthday up at Woodside.
Yeah.
I had my 24th birthday in Tobruk. My 25th birthday at Alamein.
Yeah.
In Egypt. My 26th birthday in New Guinea at Finchhaven. My 27th birthday up in North Queensland. And my 28th birthday in Borneo.
Okay.
So that's a good variety.
Yeah, terrific mix. Yeah. Now let's go back though to 21-year-old, 22-year-old William Corey. You were by that stage quite experienced in the butchery trade.
Yes.
You were living at home still?
Yes.
Okay. What about social life? What did you do?
Oh, well, in those days you used to go to dances.
Yeah.
And of course, the pitches were a common Saturday night. Everyone went to the pitches.
Where were they? Where did you go?
Well, we used to walk too from Gilberton. We'd either go to the Capitol Theatre on Paynham Road or the Ozone up in Enfield.
Yep.
And thought nothing of it.
Exactly.
It's the same as the dancers. We used to go down to the, I think they called it the Maison down the bay, and sometimes you'd miss the last tram.
Yes.
So you'd walk home from the bay to Gilberton, and you didn't think anything of it. You'd talk and joke and laugh, and there was no worries, not like, you wouldn't do that today. No. But in those days, you was quite safe walking.
And were you an accomplished dancer? You good on the floor?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was a pretty good dancer, yeah.
And what did you wear in those days?
Oh, yes. Well, you always was dressed up, you know, nicely. But, of course, when you went to the Palais, a dinner suit and stiff dicky and bow tie. Yeah. I always had that dress. I've always dressed well.
Yes.
My mother was very, well, as to say, she was born in 1880, and we lived in that simple life in Tarlee. There was no in between. The thing was either right or it was wrong. She was an old time Methodist,
yeah.
And they had very, you know, they lived very strictly.
Yeah.
So that's how I was brought up, you see. And I couldn't do anything wrong now because my conscience wouldn't allow me. It's not a matter of
exactly.
The law.
What about drinking and smoking then, back in the 1930s? Did you have a few beers?
Oh, well, yes, everyone had a few beers back in those days. I was never a big drinker, not a heavy smoker. I smoked and I had a few drinks, but I was never, I was always a very moderate person.
Can you remember what you smoked, what brand of cigarette?
Capstan,
yeah.
Okay. I can't think, but I know in the war years we used to get the tins of tobacco.
Yes.
And you'd roll your own.
Yeah.
I used to get more enjoyment out of sitting down, putting your hand in your pocket, get your tin out, get the paper out. And to me, that was, I got more out of that than the smoking of the cigarette.
And let me take you back to the dances again, then we better get on to the enlistment. But again, young ladies, your partners, your girlfriends, did you have anyone in particular in those days?
No. Well, actually, there was a young girl that seemed to be fond of me, but I didn't want to be serious in this. Now, that young girl, over in Tobruk, I put one of my friends onto writing a letter to her, Bryce Tassel. He finished up marrying that.
Lovely.
He was, he became the pay sergeant.
Yep.
And he married that girl, and she is still alive, and we have our monthly luncheons. And Shirley was down there at this last lunch. Her daughter is now secretary of our battalion club, which is not a big club these days. Used to be a big club.
Bryce Tassel, T-A-S-S-E-L. E-L, that's one L.
Two L's, I think.
Bryce Tassel. And his wife is Shirley?
Yeah.
And she was a friend, and he put... She introduced her, if you like.
Yes.
Okay. What was her maiden name?
Duray. D-U-R-Y-E-A.
Thank you.
She lived at St. Peter's. That's how I knew her, you see.
That's a lovely story.
And she's still going today, and we were talking and laughing about it last...
If I could be really candid, and I hope you don't mind, but sexual relations weren't so free in those days.
No, oh no, different world today. There was no sex before marriage or any of that kind of thing.
I did wonder, yeah.
Because when I was especially in Tobruk, I learnt more about women than I'd ever known. Mm-hmm. But I found out later they were living in fairyland. All I learned about women that wasn't really didn't work out true.
Go on.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine the talk in the desert there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Women.
Mm. So you learn a lot from talking to the other diggers.
Yeah.
You're telling me.
Mm.
Okay.
But as I say, most of it they were only dreaming.
Yeah.
Yes.
Boasting.
Yeah.
Mm. It's just that it is a remarkable contrast. I mean, these days, a couple get together a modern dance, right? Mm.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be quite intimate fairly shortly afterwards.
That's right.
Not uncommon.
Yes. No, it's an entirely different world.
Sure, sure. All right, so we've got you right up to war. And it's 1940 now.
That's right.
And you are coming up for 23 years of age. And you decide to enlist.
Yes.
What were your motivations?
Oh, well, everyone.
Yep.
Yeah. Enlisting. That was just natural to join up. Before I joined up, I did have a few months. I didn't intend to stop as long, but I went up and stayed with a couple of different cousins in the country, and I finished up stopping a bit longer. Otherwise, I left work in February, but I didn't join up until June.
Right.
In between, I did go to Tasmania and sail in some championships over there. And then I went up to my cousins and I stopped there. I thought, gee, if I don't join up soon, I'll never, it'll be too late. So that was June 1940,
yeah.
A long time after that.
Was it your sensations at the time? Was it a feeling of that you had to put down the scourge of the enemy, or did you feel it was adventure? What did you feel
about? Oh, well, I think a good part of it was adventure.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. When you're young, you're looking something, and of course, people didn't go overseas back in those days like they do today.
Yeah.
And the thought of going overseas and the stories that First World War told you, that they didn't tell you the stories about being in the trenches, they told you the stories of when they were on leave. And that was, quite good, really.
So we've got you now in 1940, and you're going to go and present yourself to the recruiting depot, and you're going to sign up, and you're going to become SX5389.
That's right.
WT Corey.
Yeah.
And was this an ambition to serve?
I wanted to join the Navy.
I wanted the Navy, because of your background. Yeah, okay.
And I went down to Birkenhead several times. No, we can't call you up. We're only calling those that have had reserve training.
Right.
And I remember the day quite plainly coming back from... I was a motorbike fellow there those days. And I come back from Port Adelaide and I'm on North Terrace and I thought of joining the Air Force.
Right.
But the Air Force was... You had to wait a lot longer. And I looked across the other side of the road and there was the AIF recruit. Shall I or shan't I? Or don't be a fool gun in the Flaming Army, you know. Or the war, it might be over. So I went across and joined the Army. So I wasn't really a keen starter in going in the Army, but I didn't know anything about it, and it was a big charging your life gun in the army.
I'm just trying to picture the scene. You're on North Terrace. Where was the recruiting depot, if you could describe it today?
The Air Force was at Parliament House, I think it was. And the AIF was on the opposite
side. Where the hotel is now. Right, okay. So you marched in there, and you became an original member of the 2nd 43rd Battalion.
That's right. We went at... When we joined, then we camped at Keswick.
Waverley
Showgrounds. And of course, we'd go home on weekends.
Yep.
And I was in the first 30 names called out to be in the 43rd Battalion.
Right. First
30. Yeah. And so they kept recruiting, and we kept growing a bit, and I think we had two companies, and we marched out and went to Woodside, and then at Woodside we filled up to full battalion.
Now, memories of those days now, what was it like? Getting used to uniform, getting used to weapons, medical side of things, injections, what was it like?
Bit of a shock.
Yeah.
Going from a comfortable home to where you had no privacy whatsoever. There was eight of you in a tent. We were in tents in those days.
Yep.
They built those the barracks later on. But we were in tents, eight to a tent. The shower. We're outside. Supposed to be hot showers, not always hot. Bit of community. The toilets were a string of seats along a thing. There was nothing private.
No.
And, you know, it was a bit... You lined up for meals. You learnt to salute. That seemed to be the most important thing. At first, we were just about saluting each other. You didn't know who. I didn't know a corporal from a captain. And I soon found out, of course. But, you know, these things are all quite different to normal life. And then the injections.
Yep. Well, the injections, that's pretty serious.
We'd never had injections. But that was a new thing. And of course, they didn't change needles, and they weren't as fine as the present ones. So that you went along the line. By the time they got to you, they were just about at take a running jump and jab it in. And do you know, some of those men used to fight.
Yeah.
When they getting up close with watching the ones in front, grown men.
Over they go.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. But, so you got an inoculation against smallpox. What other things did you get? Cholera, maybe.
Oh, we got vaccinated.
Typhoid,
Going over. Oh, I don't know, they always seem to be giving us some needle for something.
So this was 6 months, intensive training?
Yes.
And then off you went?
Yeah. Now, some of those men that went away only joined the unit just before we left. They were sent straight on embarkation leave. They come back, and we arrived over in the Middle East, and we were... only there a very short time when we went up the desert. So some of those fellas really never had any training, really. At all. And there they were in Tobruk.
So looking back at the record, you sailed on a ship from Melbourne.
Mauritania.
The Mauritania. So the liner converted to a troop ship.
Well, it wasn't converted then. It was the latest... transatlantic liner.
Right.
She was a big ship. But a lot of the chaps were in cabins.
Yeah.
I was on the deck, and sleeping in a hammock. Oh, I thought, sleep in them. But anyway, those hammocks were quite comfortable.
Right.
And we went to Colombo on that.
So you went to Fremantle and then you...
Yes, we...
Went ashore?
Picked up... Yes, we had a day's leave.
Yep.
One thing I remember, we went past, in the train, we went past a street called Rose Street.
Famous in Perth.
Famous street.
Yep.
And all the girls are out the front and they've got their panties and they're waving to us.
For the uninitiated, Rose Street is the street of brothels in Perth in the war years.
So,
And then you went, in Colombo you had to transfer to another ship.
Yes. When we got to there, they didn't take the big liners past there because they said it was too dangerous for waters. So we were to get on a ship called the New Zealander, which was an Australia, England passenger ship. But some disease broke out amongst the English soldiers that was coming out, and it had to be fumigated. So they had to look around for another ship. And this is how we come across the Navassa, an old British India troop and horse transport.
Yes.
It was a coal-burning thing, and it hadn't been in commission for a good while. So that's what we got put onto.
Can you spell that name for me?
N-E-V-A-S-S-A, I think.
Right.
Well, it couldn't keep up with the convoy. While the convoy, they used to zigzag all the way to avoid submarines. But the Navassa just kept going straight. And the only time we saw the convoy where they had destroyers to protect it was when it crossed in front of us.
Yep.
And then it would go out of sight. So we weren't very protected.
But you got there.
And every time when it got within sight, the flags would go up and you knew what they were. You got to come faster to pick up. So they'd put on, the next thing, there'd be more coal getting shoveled in, and some of it would go straight up through the funnel and it'd land on deck, big chunks of red-hot coal. But we didn't go any faster. All it did was create a lot more smoke. Anyway, a few days out, I think they must have had problem with the refrigeration because all the meat that was taken on board was tossed overboard and all the fish that they had on was all tossed overboard. So that then we went on to bully beef. That was the start of our life of eating bully beef for the next 5 years. Anyway, we got to about the Red Sea and they run out of that. And they were running out of water. So we lived then on what we call goldfish. That was herrings in tomato sauce. Not a very wonderful diet. And of course going through the Red Sea is a pretty hot area and no water to drink. All we had was a drink of tea with each meal. So, but we survived and we got there. So that was my first experience of war, was being on this Navassa.
So you arrived at the Suez Canal?
Port Chivik.
Mm. And then you had to take a train and you had to go on what you have described in your memoir as a primitive train.
Yes, expedition. Well, before we got on the train, then the vessel was supposed to go up to Kantara, halfway up the Suez Canal. Right. But that night we got there was our first experience of a enemy aircraft.
Ah.
And it was an Italian plane, but yeah. We learned afterwards that it was dropping mines right. in the Suez Canal. So, of course, the ship couldn't go up the canal, and that's how we got on the train. And we went to Kantara, where a big English camp.
So you've said here in your notes from those days, this was when the war really started for us.
Yes, well, that was our first air raid.
Yep.
But it wasn't, they didn't drop any bombs on us. But we didn't know that.
Now, you were obviously pretty quickly into action, and was this when you went to Tobruk, or was
yes.
it, you went
yeah.
straight to Tobruk?
Yeah. No, we didn't go straight there. Yeah. We went to Palestine.
Palestine. Okay.
And, you know, the reason why Australian soldiers were in Palestine, because the Egyptian government wouldn't have Australian soldiers camp because of First World War.
Really?
Yeah. They played up a bit, you know.
Oh, I see.
I think it was known as the Battle of the Wazza or something.
Yes,
you know.
There was a lot of brawling and drinking, I believe.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's why we were in Palestine.
Palestine. Mm. And you trained there in desert warfare, I assume.
Yes. In March, I think we went. We arrived there, of course, in about the end of January, I think, then. March we went up.
That's to, March 1941.
Yes.
March 41. Went up to Tobruk. So what was the situation like when your unit arrived in Tobruk? How dangerous was it? How close was the Africa Corps? Tell me about that.
No, it wasn't dangerous at that time.
Yep.
We were minding prisoners, Italian prisoners of war that the 6th Division had taken
right.
Tobruk from. And they weren't any trouble looking after. We just about all had a batman, you know, they used to shave us and cut our hair and cook, you know, some of their meals. And of course, we used to give them cigarettes. And it was all very friendly. Thing, because they weren't German prisoners, they were Italian, and they were very much, they were happy they were going to Australia, they reckon. Oh, we're going to Australia. You silly fellas, you volunteered to come over here. We were called up, we had no option, but we're going to Australia. Oh. And a lot of those men returned.
They did.
Fairly quickly after the war, because they thought Australia was the land of
right.
Oh, wonderful. I did have a man, a little story with that, did some cement work for me after I built a house, and he was telling me that he came out as a prisoner of war, but he was never in a prison camp. He was sent to working on dairy farm.
Yeah.
And those people were wonderful to him. They took him everywhere. He became like one of the family. And he said he couldn't get back to Australia quick enough. He was one of the first ones to come back. He said, I worked hard. I bought a block of land. Then I built my house. And he said, then I brought my wife. And I think he said children, but he brought his wife out then, and I thought, I've thought of that man, and I suppose those children finished up going to university, and goodness knows what they are today.
Exactly.
But when he said he was a prisoner of war, I thought, I reckon he's taken into Brook. So I said to him, where was you taken prisoner of war? He said, in a place called Tobruk. I said, I was there. Yeah. Whoa, what's it? He jumped up and he shook my hands. I thought he was going to kiss me, actually. It was so thrilled. There we were like brothers. We were both in Tobruk.
Beautiful story. Don't remember his name, Giuseppe Alberto. You don't remember?
Oh, no, don't remember.
It's a lovely story.
Don't remember.
Story. So, at first, things in Tobruk were okay. You were just minding the prisoners of war, and no particular action for a while. But when did things heat up?
Well, then the Germans landed in North Africa.
Yep.
And they came out, and then they retook Benghazi, and then all the soldiers that weren't taken prisoner of war were retreated to Tobruk.
Yes.
Now, the English commander, when he was handing over to General Morshead, he said, "You will never make soldiers out of these men. They're undisciplined, a lot of, I forget the word, but meaning a lot of rat packs. They'll never make soldiers." And they were the very men, the 20th Brigade, who were the first ones that stood up to the German onslaught of Rommel's Blitzkrieg.
Yep.
So these were the soldiers that never make soldiers. They wouldn't have made Buckingham Palace soldiers, but when it come to the real thing, they stood out on their own.
So what were the first signs of being under fire? What was it like? What happened?
I don't know. On the Easter, it was Good Friday that the Germans attacked. The 11th of April. On Good Friday morning, that was when the surrounding was complete. And then they attacked where the 20th Brigade were. So we weren't the first ones to be attacked. The 20th Brigade were, and that's where Edmondson won his VC in that attack. We didn't know much what was going on. There wasn't a communications like today. But we used to get a newsletter and a bit of paper like that printed. So that's where we got the information.
But there was artillery.
There was artillery.
You were under bombardment.
Yes.
And air raids.
Well,
constant air raids.
Constant air raids. Even at night time, there was always a plane, enemy plane, overhead. As one went out, you think, oh, well, go quiet. But another one would come in. And I think that was done more to upset us. But you got used to it and just went along. But the air raids were... we had, I think, something like 1,100 in that time. And it could be one plane, which would be an observation plane, or it could be 150, which was what they called saturated bombing.
So there's about 1,100 air raids in a period of how long, how many months approximately?
7 months.
7 months. And when an air raid... Well, you've got an air raid warning, I suppose, or you heard them.
Yeah, heard.
What did you do? Did you have a shelter or dive under a slip trench? What did you do?
Yes, well, you'd either lie flat on the ground or in a hole.
Yeah.
And then you got used to them. And they used to say that the bomb that... If you was going to get hit, the bomb that hit you, you wouldn't hear, because the noise, the screaming, would be behind the thing. So when you learnt that, when you heard the screaming of bombs coming down, you could stand out and watch it.
You must have seen some terrible things.
you got used to it.
Mm. What appalling things you must have seen, though, with death and wounding.
Mm.
Can you describe any of that to me?
Only that, you know, you got used to fellow saying, oh, so-and-so got killed, you know. But you're not in action all the time. You see, there was the red line, there's the blue line, and then there was what they called a rest area. Right. Not very restful, because you might be amongst the anti-aircraft guns, and that was called the rest camp. But I know in one instance with this rest camp, the anti-aircraft fellows, which were English bloke, they said, oh, there's a cave down the bottom of this wadi. You want to go down there at night time and have a good sleep. Oh, you know, typical Aussies. Yeah, oh, she's right. Yeah. So we just slept on the ground that night. But one fella got killed, and the cookhouse. There was no cookhouse. The cooks just cooked in the open, but yeah. They'd have a heap of boxes around where they had the, whatever they were, bully beef mostly. And that got blown up. So the next night we were down in the cave.
Yeah. You use the term, it's an Arabic term, wadi, isn't it?
Yes, wadi.
It means...
Well, the ground is very level in the desert, but there was these very deep, like, valleys, and they were called wadis. I think they had been, we were told, they'd sort of formed through water.
Exactly, yes.
Very stony. And the desert was pretty stony, too.
What about the civilian population of Tobruk?
No, I never ever saw any. No. I think the Tobruk was mainly an Italian sort of service town. But it was a good harbour.
Right.
Today, it's an oil outlet.
When you describe the red line, that's the most vulnerable area. That's the area that was attacked the most, is that right?
That was the front line.
The front line.
Okay. The blue line, you was reserve battalion. But there was always shelling going on, and they could shell just about anywhere.
Any of your mates get killed, wounded, anyone near you?
I know two fellas that were buried with bombs that we had to dig out. One I know, Freddie, he was up to about here because he couldn't do anything with his arms. It was only like his head. And when we dug him out, I never ever saw him again. That was enough. I think he was affected. But another chap, Laurie from Gawler, he got buried the same way, and he went right through the war. Mm-hmm. So that's how it affects different people.
Were you yourself called into action? You were a rifleman?
Well, not all the time. Yeah. In Tobruk, I was on the ration. Ration cart, as we called it. Yeah. We used to go into what they called the dump, which was a big pile of rations stuff. It was all covered with a big camouflage net. Now, I was speaking to a pilot when I was on leave in Cairo later, And he said that it was very difficult on a lot of days to see anything on the ground. But that camouflage net apparently used to be pretty good.
Yeah.
But a funny incident, one day we were lined up there, and of course the lining up of trucks would tell an airman that something's there. So anyway, these two fighters came and they were machine gunning us. Cyril and I were lying flat on the ground in this very fine dust with, you know, our trucks can, you can make it about that deep with fine dust.
A foot deep, yeah.
And all around us, it was a bit like if you threw a handful of stones in a pond or anything, or you, there was all these little plop, plop, plop. Well, this is what it was like in this dust. I don't know how we escaped, but neither of us got hit, although we were surrounded with these bullets. When we got up, I started to laugh. And Cyril said, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "I'm laughing at you." It wet himself.
Oh, dear.
And of course, the front of his pants was all sort of like muddy. So that's a reaction that I saw the funny side of it, and I've always seen the funny side of life. But another chap could have been affected differently.
Did you take pot shots at the aircraft at all?
No.
Couldn't do that?
No. Yeah, well, we were lying in that as flat as we could.
But I mean, other times, did you try and fire at the...
Oh, yeah.
Stall? I thought you did. Yeah.
I had another day. Now and again, there would be... We would get instructions, do not fire on a low-flying aircraft about 12 o'clock, whatever the time was, you see, because it will be one of our planes who has brought up a message from Egypt and dropped it and is flying low. Yeah. So, anyway, this aeroplane came and was flying really low, and I'm jumping up and down like a stupid person, waving my arms and jumping. And when it got to about there, instead of one of the airplanes, there was a dirty big black cross. It was a German plane. He didn't even fire, I suppose. He either thought he was over his lines, or he thought, "Oh, this bloke's too mad to fire on." So, but it was too late to be worried about anything because the plane was gone. You see.
But there was one very bad incident when, so I understand, fellas from B Company and some from A Company, they were out in no man's land, and there was a major incident in August 1941.
August the 3rd, remember.
What happened that day, Bill?
That day, it was an attack on the salient position, which was the worst position in Tobruk. The Germans had made this dent in the front line early, and it was on higher ground, so they could observe, you know, right across. So it was an important position, but it was pretty hopeless attacking it. But that was the order, and there was about 130 men involved in that. I wasn't. And I think it was roughly 30 answered the roll call after a couple of hours. There was 32 that were killed. And all the rest were injured, wounded.
Now,
70 odd.
They were dispatched to this salient to protect it against Well, the Blitzkrieg, is that correct?
No, they had... It was a planned attack on the German position.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah.
Outside the wire, in no man's land. Okay.
Yes.
A planned attack.
Yes. And then...
With high casualties.
Yes. There were 70-odd wounded, yeah, and 30-odd killed.
But there was a temporary truce, I believe, to collect the wounded.
Yes. A truck went out with the padre in the cabin, with the driver, and the sergeant of the RAP, Wally Chewett, was sitting on the bonnet with a Red Cross flag. Yep. And they went out to the as close as they could to the German lines, and a German captain came out to meet them and asked what they wanted. And they said they wanted to be able to pick up the wounded and the dead. And he agreed. He even supplied German soldiers to lift some mines and help this. They had already taken all their casualties away. But it was an unusual truce. And when they finished, the guns opened up straight away again.
Wally Chewett, could you spell that for me?
Wally, W-A-L-L-Y.
Yeah.
T-U-I-T, I think.
Oh, Chewett, yes. T-U-I-T. Thank you. Dangerous thing to do.
Dangerous thing. Well, he didn't know how he was going to get received.
I used that term earlier. The famous Blitzkrieg.
Yes.
Yes. What did that mean to you? What actually happened? Could you describe that to me?
Yes, well, they'd gone right through Europe, and people had either put their hands up for taking prisoners, or they retreated.
Yep.
And they retreated right back to Dunkirk.
Yep.
When the Germans got to Tobruk, they used the same method. The Stukas would come in, then the tanks, and then the infantry. Well, as I say, it wasn't us. It was the 20th Brigade in their section. The Stukas came. The tanks had nothing to stop the tank. We didn't have a lot of equipment, you know. 50 rounds of ammo each and a couple of hand grenades. And they had to let the tanks go through. There was about 40 tanks, you know, went through. And when the infantry come, instead of people putting up their hands or retreating, those bloody Aussies were there. And they didn't move. And they got mowed down. And I believe there was about 200 dead in the tank truck where they just got mowed down. The tanks were moving around, of course, the infantry didn't come as usual. The infantry didn't come, and the captain of the tanks called out to some fellas. I didn't hear this, but we get this on the newsletter, that... you must surrender, we have taken Tobruk. And of course an Aussie called out, pig's ass you have. And I often think of that, and I thought, that captain probably, if he lived, he probably the rest of his life was thinking, what the hell's pig's ass got to do with surrendering? And they didn't know Aussie humour, of course.
But with the Stukas bombing and the tanks and the bombardment, they did penetrate the perimeter of Tobruk to some extent?
That they did penetrate a bit. That wasn't in the salient.
No.
What I was talking about. That was on a flat country.
Yeah.
And anyway, there was about 17 of those tanks were knocked out by the English artillery, who were very, very good.
Yeah.
And they were firing, they didn't have armour-piercing shells, but they, if you blow the tracks off, they can't move.
So
they were about 17 of them, I think, were put out of out of action.
This was the famous siege, and it went on 7 months.
Yes, and I believe Rommel said, "Who are these Australians?" In other words, later on he was to say, "If I had two divisions of Australians, I'd conquer the world."
When did you first hear the term rat of Tobruk? And what were the circumstances?
Oh, well, Lord Haw-Haw, he called himself. His name was Robinson, I think, and he was hung as a traitor after the war. But he was in Germany, and he was broadcasting, and he used to say derogatory things to sort of upset our morale, and he said, "You're living like rats in the desert. Surrender. Wave a white handkerchief and you'll be looked after." And of course, General Moore said, his reply was, "We haven't got any white handkerchiefs because we haven't got any water to wash them."
And did you yourself hear these broadcasts anywhere?
Well, there wasn't many radios.
No.
I don't think that I heard them, really. We used to get it on this news ship.
Right, okay. So you talked about the fact that the general had said there was no water. Now, conditions for you without water must have been appalling. Can you describe that to me, how bad it was, how you survived without the water intake and without proper food? How did you get by?
Well, I don't know. They tell us today we've got to drink a lot of water.
Exactly.
We didn't have any water. But a lot of us were country chaps, you know, brought up without a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't big drinkers of water anyway, you know. And I think we were the Australians were probably the most suited to the desert because Europeans, it was a foreign area, whereas to Australians, it wasn't foreign to see miles of dry, dusty country.
But what was the ration like, though, per man? What did you get, and how did you use it, and how did you survive on that?
Well, I don't know. I never had a wash in 7 months. I did have two swims in the Mediterranean when we were in a rest position. And we mostly only wore a pair of shorts and shirt now and again, you know. But we didn't know about all the skin problems. I don't know. I've never had the skin problems. So
did you shave?
We had to shave.
Yeah.
A little bit of water, that water bottle full.
Yeah.
That had to go a long way.
So you got a water bottle full every day?
Yes, at one stage every second day.
One water bottle every second day for washing, such as it was, shaving and drinking.
Drinking.
That was it?
That was it. We had a cup of tea at meals.
Yep.
But, you know, in those dust storms, which any of the chaps would tell you, we've had dust storms in Australia, but they were shocking. You think of all those trucks, tanks and that moving around. They churned up the ground that you got this fine, powdery top. And then these sandstorms mixed with the dust, the cooks had to prepare meals in it, all out in the open.
Yes.
You ate your meals sitting out there, and you lived in it, you know. So sometimes a cup of tea, you couldn't drink the last bit because it was a bit muddy, or the same with a stew made with bully beef. You was eating dirt with it, you know. But we survived.
And at the end of that time, having survived, You were relieved by an Allied force. What happened again?
Well, we came out of Tobruk on destroyers. Now, there was 22 ships were sunk bringing supplies up to us. We, you know, all you hear about is Tobruk and the army, but those Navy blokes and merchant Navy fellas that brought ships up to Tobruk, there was 22 ships sunk, including an English cruiser, which is a fairly big ship. And that cruiser was supposed to bring the last battalion out of Tobruk, 2nd, 13th. They never ever got out because this cruiser was sunk on the way out.
And then among the unsung heroes, if you like, of that period as well, was a Polish force, wasn't there?
Yes, a Poles came in to relieve us, actually.
Yes, the Carpathian Brigade, is that right?
I forget what called them.
Yeah.
Yes, but...
So the Poles came in to relieve the 2nd 43rd.
Well, actually, that's who they relieved, yes. Well, our brigade, I think, brigade, probably there might have been three battalions.
Right,
so.
Right.
And I had a little experience with them because we were out in what they call the fig tree area, the only tree that was in Tobruk, and it was growing in a cave.
Right.
And that cave was just a hollow in the ground, really. And the RAP were based in there.
Regiment Leg Post, yep.
We were coming in from the front line with half a dozen empty 44-gallon water drums in the back of the truck. There was three of us in the back of the truck. There was two in the cabin, the driver and the major. And we tipped over. And we tipped over. This is pitch dark, of course, because that's the only way you could go to this area. And the Germans had this particular point where you got onto, there was a road right through, from Egypt right through that the Italians had built. And in some places it was perhaps 2 or 3 feet above the desert, other places it was level. And this place, we'd come down from this fig tree area and was getting on the road, which was 2 or 3 feet above the level. And the driver got the two offside wheels on the, went over the side and we tipped over. The three of us in the back and half a dozen of these 44-gallon drums, we all went flying and none of us were injured. And you just imagine the weight of these drums, if one of them had hit you going through, you could have been killed. Anyway, we had to move out of that area fairly quickly. Actually, it happened that he didn't open up with his guns, but he did have that particular point, you know, really on his positions. And we're walking along the road. We get this foreign voice, "Halt!" So we pulled up. Password. Every night you used to have a different password, see? Password, none of us could think of the password because you used, most of the time you used to be told and you'd forget it in 5 minutes. And things were a bit dicky there for a while because these Polish fellas, or they really hated the Germans because of Poland, you know. There, we didn't know what, Australians don't know what hate is. And while this was, it was a bit silent for a while, and one of these fellas who used to, you know, if he spoke 6 words, 3 of them would be swear words, and he was carrying about the bloody this. And the Polish fella said, "Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Okay, Aussies." he recognised. So a sticky situation was saved by Australian swearing.
The Bowles knew it was an Aussie. That's a lovely story. It, just to jump ahead a long way, the Polish authorities have recognised your service. You've got a medal, the Pro Patria medal.
That's right. Mm.
That's a beautiful thing. How did that happen?
Well, that was given to us after the war, and it was sent to the Rats of Tobruk Association.
Yes.
Now, there wasn't one for everyone.
Right.
If you was fortunate enough, you received one. And so I've got one. I was president of our battalion at the time. But, so, and that Bill Robinson, he said, oh, I've never got one. And so it went on, and that's how he came to meet that Polish.
You've said in a previous memoir about your time over there that spiders, scorpions, fleas and rats get into your blankets at night.
Yes, you never. We only had one blanket, and it could get pretty cold at night time there. But whether you put that, you laid on it, or whether you put it on top, if you laid on it, you didn't have anything on top. And if you didn't, if you had it on top, you was lying on the just the ground. Anyway, you always shook this blanket before you got up. I got a bite, or not a bite, it's a nip with his tail of a scorpion. I put my hand in the haversack to get something out, and I knew straight away what it was. And I could feel this numbness going up the arm, and a lump under the arm, and I thought they were poisonous. Yeah, deadly poisonous. They are poisonous, but not deadly. The doctor said, "Oh no, they won't kill you, but it's not a nice feeling." And but there was a rat. I had an experience with a rat. He had a hole in the bottom of my hole, and he used to stick his head out, and I thought, this was in one position. We were always in different holes. So I lay there, and I had the bone at about an inch above this hole, and I thought, well, I'll get you, mate. He stuck his head out, and, you know, I couldn't do it. I thought, well, this is his territory. He hasn't done anything to me, and I couldn't kill him.
That's a lovely story. Soldier, yeah. Butcher, but you couldn't kill him.
And yet, you know, as an infantry who did have to pull the trigger, it's unbelievable.
It's a beautiful story. So you were in, this was a trench?
No, just a hole.
Hole in the ground?
Yes.
And you had to sleep in that?
Yeah.
So you slept in the open most of the time, did you?
Yeah. Well, yes, or holes. You used to dig these holes. We were always digging, always digging holes.
That's a lovely. He was a real rat. You were a rat at Brook, but he was a real rat.
Well, we were. Yeah. And, of course, Lord Hellhor knew that we was living like rats.
So we've got you through to Brook.
Well, one interesting story in to Brook. See, I wasn't permanently out on that front line.
Yeah.
But I used to, when the battalion was in the front line, I was out there every day because delivering the rations. Well, in this position, it happened to be one where you could only do it at night time. We had a newly appointed captain quartermaster, and Eric said to me, "Oh, you blokes get it, for, you know, easy, you know." I said, "Well, why not come out with us tonight?" Well, it just happened to be one of those nights. We got out to the first company, and the shells started coming over. And one of the fellows said, "Get that bloody truck out of here, you're drawing the crabs." And I said, "Well, if you want something to eat, mate, you've got to put up with it." So we went along the three companies, I think, always one in reserve, and we started to come back, and the driver got off the track. They used to have a tape the track because of mines. It was all minefields, and he got in the minefield.
Right.
So the captain said, "Yeah, you better pull up." So I pulled up, and I said, "Well, I think I know where the track is. I'll walk in front of the truck, and we'll." But we got back to the to where the tape was. How the hell we didn't run over a mine, I don't know. How I didn't tread on the mine, I don't know. So anyway, we got going, and the shells kept coming over, and the captain said, "You better pull up and switch the engine off and see what happened." Well, the shells still kept coming over, and I was lying between the two front wheels of the truck for protection, and a shell landed, I'm not kidding, only a few feet in front of the truck, 6 or 7 feet, and it didn't go off. I think there was a lot of sabotage with those workers in Germany, probably Polish women or something that used to, wouldn't have been any, they didn't used to put the detonators, I believe, in there. And anyhow, Eric said, "Well, we better get going." So we all the rest of the way we got followed with these shells. They were on about the right line, but they weren't, they were just to the side. Nothing was said when we got back. But he never ever came out on the Russian truck again at night. Anyway, we got back to Alexandria and went back to Palisade, where we had Christmas. And after Christmas, the battalion moved up to Syria, up near the Turkish border. The 6th and 7th Division had came back to Australia, and we thought we were coming back too. But the English had different ideas. They didn't want us to be going. And, of course, then at that time, Rommel had come down, right down to within 50 miles of Alexandria. And so we arrived at the Alamein.
So you said then, here in your notes when you were recounting your biography, you were back in the desert, but El Alamein was a lot different from Tobruk.
It was different. It was the same and yet different.
Yeah.
The same desert, but we weren't cut off from supplies. So we had a bit more water. We never had any surplus water at any time for washing and that, you know, but we had more water to drink. And I don't know that the supplies were much different, but of course there was ammunition and all that was all brought by land. El Alamein was so much different in that most of the aeroplanes that we saw were ours instead of German ones. They were mostly American ones, Boston bombers, Kitty Hawk and Tomahawk fighters. The tanks were mostly American, Crusaders, I think. And anyway, when we arrived, British soldiers, they cheered. They said, the Aussies are here. We'll be all right now. So that's how much faith they had in Australians. We'll be all right now, the Aussies are here.
Didn't you have one incident, though, where some aircraft, a squadron, supposed to be on your side, actually attacked you? The Free French?
I just don't remember.
I understand that a squadron of Free French Hurricanes fighters machine gunned you at ground level, and you did suffer some casualties.
Oh, well, that could happen too. And I was talking to a fighter pilot, Australian, in Cairo when I was on leave, and he told me it was very hard to distinguish on the ground.
Yep.
There was a sort of a haze that would go, and some days you couldn't see anything on the ground. So, but anyway, yes.
What was the noise like, the noise level from the guns at Elanane?
Well, that October the 23rd at 20 to 10, at exactly that time we were all looking at our watches, nearly 1,000 guns opened up. The noise was absolutely unbelievable. And the flashing of the guns was lit up like daylight. And that was the opening of the offensive, which put Rommel out of there.
This actually changed the course of the war, didn't it?
Yes, that was the turning point of the war.
Yes.
And on the I don't remember a great lot after that. Then the November the 1st, this was the turning point. The 2nd 48th had fought to just about a standstill. And we were sent in to relieve the 48th. Rommel thought, oh, we've got this, the Aussies, we've nearly knocked them out. Well, this is our opportunity to go through to it. But they found the 2nd 43rd there in their way. And so the next few days, that was a very hard fighting time, and a lot of action. And on the 4th of November, they retreated.
This was a time of constant shelling,
yeah.
Not much water, minefields, very dangerous.
Yeah, minefields. Minefields were everywhere. I believe Arabs were getting killed years afterwards with mines. There was that many mines laid that, and of course the records of where they were laid were lost, sure. And you know, things. But anyway, the on the November the 5th, the next day after the Germans retreated, was Guy Fawkes Day. Everyone was going mad, and that's when we had a tragedy. The last German plane that came over dropped a bomb, or bombs, and at that time we had a truckload of reinforcements arrive. And that truck was hit. There were several killed and wounded, and they had never seen any action at all, but they were killed in action.
Sure.
So that's your luck.
Yeah. What we didn't mention, though, and I'd like to be quite candid about this, was at Tobruk and at Elanane, surely the disease you would have suffered.
Well, there was a... I think there was a malaria,
yeah.
A bit different type, I think, to what was in the jungle. But sores were, you know, wouldn't heal, and because dysentery was shocking. Flies, I thought all the flies were in Australia, but there's plenty over there. Anyway, that was after that. We were withdrawn back to Palestine, and the next thing we knew, we were on the Queen Mary coming home to Australia.
Describe that voyage to me.
The
voyage on the Queen Mary, what was it like? What did you do?
Well, it was wonderful to be on this huge ship, the Queen Mary, but of course we had to share it with the 11,000 others. You know, we travelled thousands and thousands of miles on ships, almost sailors, you know, and if any of those ships had been hit, you would have had no chance of getting out of them. You just imagine 11,000 on the Queen Mary if that had been hit by a submarine.
Oh, well, you said that you were way below deck, 11 decks down, like 11 stories in a building. But did you get up and enjoy the fresh air and see the ocean and that sort of thing?
Oh, yes, yes. We used to get up on the deck. And when we left Perth, where we dropped troops off, there was a barge came out with fresh vegetables and stuff. And all the lads are throwing cigarettes down to the wharfies that are on it. And they were sitting there and nothing was happening. Now, I said to a chap next to me, you know what's going to happen next? There'll be a call for a working party. Yeah. And do you know those fellas would not unload that stuff because they wanted danger money. They were 3 miles offshore. Yeah. Now, that was our introduction back to Australia, the wharfies with going on strike.
Pretty sad, but you got by and you got to Sydney. That must have been a phenomenal moment for you.
Oh, yes. Sydney Harbour, the entrance to there was wonderful. See all these red roofs on the houses, because everything over in the Middle East was painted white. and of course, then we got on the train and came home. And coming around that bend there just after Eden Hills, you could get a sight of Adelaide, and it was wonderful.
So how long were you at home?
A couple of weeks, and then we were off again.
Yeah. What did you do? Did you go dancing again and go down to the Palais? What did you do?
I don't remember. We mostly used to... Although we were home, we would still gather around in town to see the fellas that you was with. It was strange. Anyway, the...
So we've got to early 1943 now.
Yes, and we went to New Guinea.
And that took a lot of training. You had to get ready for the jungle, didn't you?
Yes, we had some training, and we had some training of getting on the barges of a ship. You see, they'd throw a rope net over the side, and you'd have to climb down the side. It was like climbing down of a multi-story building. Climb down with all your equipment and rifle on it and get in the barge that's bobbing around down the bottom. So... that was our introduction to the landing barges, and we did that at Cairns.
So off you then went to war again, to Milne Bay.
That's right. We went to Milne Bay and we got washed out there. There was inches of rain. There was you was walking around in water. And they moved us up to Buna. Buna had just been taken by the 7th Division, and that was our jumping off point for Ley.
Now, this was a different enemy and different terrain. Could you compare it?
No comparison. It was like two different wars in every way. The jungle to the desert, rain to no rain, and... the warfare was totally different. You was just walking along tracks. There was no roads, and these tracks, it was pretty awful, I tell you. It was.
What was your first sighting of the enemy?
At Ley, I had a man named, no, I won't get into that story. We landed at Ley, about 15 miles from Ley itself. And we that was called Red Beach, you know, for identification. So we, on the way to Ley, of course they met, the battalion met Japs. We had a few casualties there.
Including a man you knew, who was a relative of your sister, apparently, a relative of yours.
Yes, well, we couldn't, when we got to the Busu River, we couldn't get across it.
Yeah.
Because it was flowing at about, well, I think they said about 25 miles an hour. And the barge fellow said that you could get fresh water about a mile out to sea. You could see the river, a brown river sort of going out there. While we were waiting to get across, I was talking to this friend, Frank Cotton, from Streaky Bay. And I went back to my little section a bit further along the river. And I just got back there and someone said, Frank Cotton's been killed. It was a shell come over. So I was born lucky. I just moved away.
He, in fact, was related.
Well,
he was sister-in-law.
He was a cousin of my sister-in-law, yeah.
Yeah, so.
He was, I think he was a farmer.
Yeah.
His brother was a doctor at Streaky Bay.
And Bill, there was an incident where you were with another soldier, one of your comrades.
Yes.
And a Japanese came out with his hands up. He was holding a bayonet.
Yeah.
You were going to take him prisoner. And then
yes.
Two Americans intervened.
Well, we were going to, I was with a young lad, about 20, just joined the unit. And we were just searching around the area, you know. And there was a cave there, see. And we were thinking about going in. And this Japanese come out. All he had on was a pair of trousers. And we were going to take him prisoner because they wanted information, you know, of where the Japs had gone to because they'd evacuated the place. Anyway, two Americans from the boat, barge people, came running up. They were two big fellas and they got the revolver in their hand and they said, let me kill the bastards, Aussie, let me, we don't get a chance to kill them. And this young bloke, in the excitement, you know, that went on, he pulled the trigger. And there was a magazine, went into that chap's chest and it spouted blood on every, you know, there was all these bits. Shocking because that lad, I should think, he remembered that for the whole of his life.
Sure.
I mean, I remember it, I saw it, it was shocking, but I didn't pull the trigger, you see. So that makes the difference.
But you did later, and you have written about an occasion where, again, going through the jungle, suddenly four Japs came round the corner. And you had to take some pretty swift action.
Yes, yeah, so I shot four of them, actually.
Yeah.
It was something I've never forgotten.
Yeah, I can understand that, Bill.
There's a lot of things with the war. They don't affect me at all. But the fact of killing someone.
Yeah. But you were in uniform, they were in uniform.
Oh, I know that, but I was brought up in a Christian family.
Yeah. Well, I think you can balance that, but please, if you want to say something else, please.
It's against the grain to do that.
Sure. Sure.
Anyway, it's happened and goodbye.
But you didn't shoot the rat at Tobruk, did you? The little rat that put his head up.
That's right.
You let him go.
I couldn't kill him.
No. I understand that.
Anyway, from Leigh then, we went to Finchhaven.
Yep.
Further up the coast.
Yeah.
And that was where we had got a struggle with the Japs.
Yeah.
Of course, we were always on the move. We were never in one spot. You're continually... That was another thing with the jungle. Of course, we were winning and we were chasing Japs more than the Japs chasing us, you see. But to tell you what conditions were like, the Japs re-landed on our beach.
Really?
With about four barges, I think. And they nearly retook the beach. We would have been stranded if they'd got that. And I was with a company that we were about 4 miles out. I was on the, what they call the Bonga track. It was further up the coast. And we were told to get back as quick as we could because the Japs had landed on the beach. So that was about 8 o'clock. By the time we got going, it was about 10 o'clock. It was only 4 miles, but it took us till 7 o'clock to arrive the next morning. It was pitch dark, raining. You couldn't see. You put your hand out in front to touch the fella to keep contact. And when you was at the back, you'd call out, "Go slower in the front." When you was at the front, yes, if we can't go any slower, we'd be stopped. So that was what conditions were like. It took all those hours to do 4 miles.
And you got very sick as well, I believe.
Oh, well, I had dengue fever, which makes it pretty cool.
Sure.
I had malaria a couple of times afterwards. But I flew back to Port Moresby. To the hospital, and coming back to the battalion, we were on board a DC-3. They only had a ceiling of 10,000 feet, and those peaks up there, you know, 11,000 or 13,000 feet. We were flying along, and suddenly, over on its side. And of course there's no seats in there, so we all got tossed and down and down and down until quite calmly I remember saying to myself, "Oh well, this is it, it's my turn."
So you thought the aircraft was going to crash?
Yeah. And it suddenly leveled out and it went up like a lift. Those down and up drafts in the mountains. And when we got back to Finchhaven, the pilot opened the door and there was this kid about 20, was the pilot. He said, "How'd you like that, boys?" The boy said, "No, bloody good." He said, "Well, I thought we were gone too." But he said, "If you can keep..." I was able to keep the nose of the plane up.
Yeah.
He said, "And that's the secret." And he said, "That's well..." Now, in 2015, they found one of these DC-3s in a place just like I was describing, in one of these big valleys, and there was 26 soldiers on it. So apparently that's what happened to that one. That nearly happened to me too. But my luck held out.
And you got back to Australia.
Yeah.
So did you fly back or sail back?
No, we came back by ship to Townsville, I think we came back to. And I didn't think we'd go away again.
You've done a fair bit.
Yeah, but anyway, we had some leave and we were up there for quite a good time at North Queensland. And, of course, then we got on an American ship to go to Borneo.
Yes, before we talk about Borneo, though, you had a spot of leave back in Australia.
Yeah.
You coming back to Adelaide again?
Or yes, back to Adelaide.
Okay. Mm. And seeing your family?
Yes.
Wonderful reunion?
Yes, well, my mother had a... You think of these things after. You know, I had a brother who was 29. He was married and never been ill. He, him and his wife, they were out playing bridge the night before. Yeah. And Alec didn't get up, and his wife, Gwen, said, "Oh, I'll get breakfast." He's probably sleeping in his time. When she went back, he was still hadn't moved. She pulled back the sheet, and the pillow was covered with blood.
Lord.
He'd had a, is it an aneurysm?
Aneurysm, yeah. At the age of 29.
29, he'd never been ill.
Gracious.
And 3 months to the day, I had a sister just 18 months younger than me. And she got water up her nose. She was in swimming and got some water up her nose. And the doctor thought she had the flu, but it was meningitis.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's that type,
sure,
that they had no cure for. And in about a week, she went to skin and bones and she died. My brother was prisoner of war with the Japs. And I was in Tobruk. So, you know, it makes you think of these people.
Doesn't it?
We weren't the only ones to suffer.
Exactly. Your brother, who was a prisoner of war, what unit was he with then?
He was with the 8th Division.
Ah, of course.
Ammunition subpark.
Oh, subpark. Mm. Yep, yep. And what was his... Did he survive the war?
Yes, he did survive. He was up on the Burma Road.
Right.
And... But he survived, and he lasted about 10 or 12 years, I think. He was a big, tall, well, thin chap when he went away, but he put on a lot of, I call it baby fat. You know, didn't look right. And he really didn't have a... It wasn't Jack, you know. I think all the go had been sort of knocked out.
Sure. I've interviewed a number of those men. One can understand that. Totally,
yeah.
Totally.
But anyway, there's a twist to that story. His
yes.
grandson
yes.
is a teacher, and he teaches English in Japan. He's married to a Japanese girl. He has 3 children, 2 boys and a girl, and the eldest boy is Jack Corey, after his great-grandfather.
Nice.
And there he is, a Japanese boy going to school, and his name's Jack Corey.
It comes around, doesn't it?
But Jack never had a real hatred. He said there was good Japanese, but everyone doesn't say this, but he said there was good Japs, but they couldn't do anything, really, the system.
Sure.
You know, they couldn't help him very much, you know.
So after all that leave and a bit of reunion and family happiness and sadness as well.
And you were... yes. Then we were off to Borneo.
Well, but what I'm going to ask you here is, you're a man, you're highly articulate, you're a good soldier, you did everything right, you're an incredible survivor. Weren't you selected for officer training or anything like that? So it surprises me.
I had no interest at all in... I never ever wanted to tell anyone else what to do.
Really? Yeah.
Now, when my son was called up with National Service,
yeah.
when the Vietnam time came, my advice to him was different. My father was a country chap. He didn't know anything really about the
life in Sydney, right. And I knew nothing about the army. So my advice to him, if you have, there's two armies, if you have the choice to become an officer, you take it because that's the best army. And don't, if you have a choice of what you go into, don't go in the infantry. And he went into Army Service Corps.
Yeah.
And that led on to, he finished up continuing and had 20 years to become a senior officer. But he didn't go on with that. He graduated from Staff and Command College to be a Lieutenant Colonel, but he was offered a job at International Company, British Aerospace, and then he spent 10 years with them and then 15 years with Serco. So two big international companies, and he had a wonderful business career, all led on from being selected to go to officer school.
So that's Lieutenant Colonel Don Corey.
He was a major, you see, but his appointment, his next appointment would have been
Lieutenant. You take that rank.
Yeah. Yes.
But you remained a private.
Yes.
And you didn't even want stripes? You were quite happy?
No, I never had them.
Were you offered them and knocked them back?
No, because I never gave myself the opportunity.
Okay.
No. It was a long period, 5.5 years.
It's an enormous amount of time.
And when we got home, I arrived home from Borneo by train.
Yeah,
you know, we'd come by boat. I came home on an LST. Fastest speed was 10 knots. Long way for that.
So what sort of craft is that?
Well, landing craft,
yeah.
Tanks. They're bigger than the personal ones.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got off a train at Keswick. We were taken out to Hampstead and discharged, you know, within a couple of hours.
Yeah.
After 5.5 years, there I was, arriving home, and I'm out in the street as a civilian.
Yeah.
Shocking.
It's an incredible shock, as you say. And I just wanted to spend a moment, though, before reflecting on that great emotional feeling about Borneo, because I think we've ignored that a bit.
Yes.
That was a significant campaign.
Well,
what are your memories there?
Yes, we landed at Labuan Island, which is at the entrance to the bay, and that's where the airstrip, and that was the important part again. But I don't think we needed to worry, because when we got to the airstrip, you've never seen anything like it. It was completely holes, big holes with water in them. And the Japanese planes that were around the edge were all smashed up. And I know when we were at Moratai, that's where we assembled to go to Borneo. Flying Fortress, I've never seen so many Flying Fortresses there. And I guess they were the ones that did the bombing. That landing was different to our other landings. You know, we'd been used to Australians who were always battling with the under-equipment, you might say. And this was under American command. General MacArthur was there. And there was 83 ships left Moratai. That's a big convoy. 40 of us, they divided, so I suppose about 40 of us were at Labuan Island, and the other ships went into Brunei. It was American style, which is big. There was all the barges. We climbed down from the ships we were on into these barges. There was rocket barges.
There was two cruisers that were shelling stuff over there. I had no doubts that there wouldn't be any problem landing on the beach, because you couldn't have lived under the pounding that was going on. But of course we were full of all young fellows then, you see, reinforcements, and they would have seen it different to me. I enjoyed the scenery. It was a sight that you would never ever see again, of all these barges all streaming towards the shore, you know, and there's all the white water behind the barges. It was really a wonderful picture.
So there you were, second 43rd still, seen a lot, one of the veterans of the campaign, seen it all, but now it was a bit different. You encountered the Japanese again in Borneo. It was still dangerous.
It was still dangerous. Yeah. We had the least casualties there. You could say it was the easiest campaign sort of we'd been in. But to all these new ones in the units, they would have seen it different. Yeah.
Now, you were welcomed in particular by the people of Borneo. They were pleased to see you.
That's the only time that we have been in contact with people. And they were on the Buren Island, they were returning to the town part. In Borneo itself, just before the war finished, was the happiest day I had in the army. The battalion put on a day for the children. Now, there was no one at this town, Beaufort. It was only a British administration town, really. And the war hadn't finished, but the Japs had retreated, and they put on this day that fellas made seesaws and swings, and they were running races for the children. I had a Miss Beaufort for the girls, and they had the time of their life. They'd never had a happy day like that. That's what made us so happy, because I don't know where they hid all these clothes from, because they used to get around and look as ugly as they could.
Because they were occupied, the Japanese.
And even the children had to salute every Japanese. If they walked past a Japanese, they had to salute him. And of course, meeting the Aussies, they couldn't get over it. And they'd come out with all this coloured clothing, and in the evening, the adults, they put on, the Chinese put on acts and dancing, and the Malays put on theirs. And some of them, I don't know where they lived, out in the jungle somewhere, but those that were still there, hadn't walked home, they just slept out on the... Yeah. On the ground.
Of course, you...
Which you could do back in those...
Exactly. You went by now, as I said, you were one of the veterans of the 2nd 43rd. You were turning 28 years of age.
That's right.
Now, you've got a significant thing about each of your birthdays. 7th August is your birthday. So the first one in the army, you turned 22 at Woodside.
23 at Woodside.
Right, okay. What happened after that?
Tobruk.
Yep.
25th.
Yep.
At Alamein.
Right.
26th at up on the Tablelands.
Right.
No. 26th in New Guinea.
Right.
27th up on the Tablelands, and the 28th in Borneo.
28th in Borneo.
So there's a few different places for a birthday.
Well, that was the 7th of August. Which is a very significant time in another respect, because the bomb.
That's right, the day before birthday, the 6th of August.
When did you know about the bomb?
Oh, I don't know, we seemed to know straight away.
Yeah.
Uh,
I know we didn't have communications like you have today, but I think we knew straight away. Somebody had, there would have been a radio probably at headquarters or something. And
so the bombing of Hiroshima and of Nagasaki, and then Japan surrendered.
Yes.
How did you know, what was apparent, first of all, about the surrender? What did you see? What did you sense? How different were things?
Well, we didn't know what to expect. But the Japanese came in like lambs. Yeah. They were no problem at all. It wasn't what we really expected. We thought they might be difficult to handle, but they weren't.
So what did you do with them?
Well, they were put into camp. And now, I didn't have much to do with this because I was on the list to come home, you see. Right. And I spent 3 months doing nothing, waiting to come home. I was high on the list because of my thing. But they decided that married men would have first opportunity. Yeah. And then they called for tradespeople. Right. And it's surprising how many tradespeople.
You're a butcher.
Oh, yeah, but I was too honest. I was left, you know, and it took me 3 months before I got a hand.
Because you would have been one of the priorities since you'd been serving such a long time.
Yeah.
But you still had to wait 3 months.
Yeah. A bit disappointed, you know.
And you got back here. Yeah. You were discharged.
Yeah.
And you said, suddenly, what do I do now?
You're just out in the street. And the strange thing of 5.5 years of living with just men.
Sure.
And under all those terrible conditions, really, you wasn't equipped for civilian life. And it's, in a way, it was the best thing that happened to me, but I didn't plan it that way. I was going to have a good holiday, go up in the country with one of my cousins,
right.
You know. And but I worked for a family before I went away, and I didn't really work. They weren't like a boss. I become part of that.
That's
family.
The Medwell family?
No, that was the Powell's butcher shop.
Yeah. Powell's Butchers?
Yes. And there was two, well, their name was Cantlin because their mother married Powell a second time in the life.
Oh, it was the Medwells took you sailing, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were the sailing.
But the Powell's were the butcher shop. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So, and Jack heard that I was home. This was about a week after I was home. And he came around, you couldn't help us out, could you? You know, because there was no labour, you know.
Sure.
Everyone was working long hours and that. I said, righto. So I, instead of having that holiday, I started work. And that put me back in contact with people.
So you're back
coming
in
the shop.
In the butcher shop again.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And I think that was the best thing that that happened. And then, of course, I met a young lady.
Can I talk about that in a few minutes? I just want to talk about the adjustment to peace. One hears so much these days about post-traumatic stress disorder. Clearly, a number of things you saw were emotionally disturbing. You'd been in the front line, you'd been under fire, you'd been bombed, all sorts of things, you'd been very ill. Yet you had this job. Did you sleep well? Were you at peace?
I could never understand this.
Yeah.
The only thing that's affected me, as I just said earlier, was having pulled that trigger.
I understand that, Bill, completely. I totally understand that and see how deep and profound that sentiment is amongst you, amongst your many memories of war. But then you had the job, and I suppose the job acted as a bit of a diversion.
That's right.
And helped you to meet people who are no doubt delighted to see you again.
Yeah.
And you held things together.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, as I say, I met this young lady, and I think she took a bit of a shine to me or something. And, but I didn't know how to talk to a girl. I learned a lot about girls when I was in the Abbey, but it wasn't the
I think there was just a lot of men boasting about their conquests.
Yes, yeah, living in fairyland. So anyway, she persevered with me, and she worked in the Shell Company, and the Shell Company used to have a ball at the Palais in those days, and she wanted to get engaged. This is only a couple of months after we met, yep. You know. And so we got engaged, and I said, well, very romantically, well, I suppose we're engaged, we might as well get married. So I was married in that October.
Right. So 1946.
Yeah.
So this is Iris. What's Iris' surname?
Yes.
Iris
Sullivan.
Iris Sullivan, right? Mm-hmm. So Iris Sullivan, now you'd met at a dance, is that right?
Yes.
Where was the dance?
At the Druids Hall in Walkerville.
Druids Hall, Walkerville. And go on, you saw her across the room and say, may I have the pleasure? Is that how it started?
No. A girl that I knew, well, she was a married woman then, but we went to Walkerville School.
Right.
She said to me, Bill, will you walk home with Iris, because she's very nervous. And you got to realise everyone walked everywhere in those days. So I walked up to Broadview and took her home.
And the dance was at the Druids
Hall
in Walkerville. And you walked up to Broadview.
And then back to Gilberton.
Right. And then didn't think anything about it.
But I bumped into her again. So,
go on.
And that was the fatal.
Deliberately, or how did that happen?
No, just accidentally. And I thought, well, I suppose I should ask her out or something. So I said, what about, do you want to come to the pictures? You know, it sounds all simple today, because the world was different back in those days.
Where did you bump into her? How did you bump into her?
Oh, down at Glenel.
At the Palais?
No, at Gnog, at the beach.
On the beach?
There was a group of us lads together, and there's a group of these girls.
So you met Iris again.
And I met her, and that was where it carried on.
So you went to the pictures?
Yes.
Can you remember what you went to see?
Oh, no, I don't remember.
And so you went to the pictures, and then you started courting.
Yeah. So it wasn't very long, as I say, we got married.
Yeah.
And that was about 61 years. And people think this is strange, but really, we never had an argument in all those years. We had different opinions. Mostly, she was protective of the children, and I thought the children have got to get out into the world, and that's where you learn.
Sure.
So that was the main difference that we had. Other than that, we had a wonderful life, and I've been fortunate. I had my own business, and that was quite successful. I've had a very good life. Oh, and recently on Australia Day, I met Senator Penny Wong.
Yeah.
And talking to her, I just happened to say that I was in Borneo, you know. She said, that's where I come from. She come from Jesselton. Her mother was Australian, I believe, and her father was Chinese. They divorced, and her mother come back to Australia. So it's funny how you meet people and you make a connection.
Now, you mentioned your business. You opened your own butcher shop. Mm. Tell me where that was.
On Glen Osborne Road, Fruville.
Yeah.
Opposite where, I saw the Ark of being built. And now it's a big food land area. And, of course, I lived in the district. I worked in the district. I knew all the people. It was a bit like continuing on my country life.
So you built a house or bought a house in Fruitvale?
No, I had one built.
One built. In Fruitvale?
Yes, alongside the Ovals, Glenger Ovals. And we lived there for 43 years.
What did you do for recreation in those days? Back sailing again?
Oh, sailing.
Yeah.
Yes, well then I bought my own.
Go on.
Boat. So, had that for 25 years at the Yacht Squadron. And I had two fellas come with me. In all those years, we never had any arguments or anything. One was a prisoner of war with the Japs, and he lived by me, and the other was connection through the wife. Len Norman, they were a wine family, with Normans, wines, and we went all those years. But then, I was 65 when I finished sailing, which covered a period of 50 years, really. But I was left to look after my boat on my own. And I could, it was too much.
What sort of boat was it?
It was sailing. Sailing
what
boat.
What was the class?
No, just a small cruising boat.
Yep. Mm. Did you take part in any particular events?
Oh, yeah, I used to race every Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah, and went across to Vincent.
So right across the Gulf?
Yeah. Easter time, the Yacht Squadron always used to go across there. I suppose I was a bit selfish that I, you know, sailed so much. But my wife realised that it was part of me.
Sure.
And a big help to me, really. But then my two friends got on the sick list, and I was 65. I couldn't. You got to go up on the slipway and paint. No, there's maintenance, a lot of maintenance with boats. And so I sold that and I bought a caravan.
Okay.
So I had 10 years then of caravanning, but my wife enjoyed the caravanning.
Yeah.
So that was very happy times with me.
And you had all those exotic, well, they were adventures in the war. Yeah. You saw some remarkable places, extraordinary sights for a young man.
That's right.
South Australia. What about overseas travel in these post-war years? Did you do any of that?
Well, I've had what you have to say is an absolutely remarkable life in my 90s. You see people, they think they're old when they're 80, but at 90, my wife died when I was 90, and I was, at 91, I was feeling a bit down, lonely. You don't notice at just at the time, it's a bit later on. You're on your own and you're a bit lost. I got a phone call from Canberra. Would I be interested in going back to Borneo? Oh, would I? So, well, we can't say that you are selected, but we will let you know further. So I knew I'd be selected because I thought, well, nobody's got more war service than what I've got. And anyway, they had one from each state. There was two sailors, one Air Force, and to army.
And who organised this?
The Canberra veterans, you know.
That's fierce.
I don't know, just all that organisation. And you see, the people of Brunei were so pleased and happy with Australians, they built a memorial.
Yep.
There for Australians, and they. We were at the invitation of the government, and that was a wonderful trip. I tell you, they were looked after just like first class in everything, you know. And I went to a dinner by the government, and sitting to this next to this chap at the table, and I was talking to him all night, and just like old mates. And towards the end, he said, "I had received a very pleasant letter today, informing me that I've been made Chief of the Armed Services." I thought, oh, hell, there's Bill, private now, and he's talking like an old mate to this chap. Anyway, that was a wonderful trip. Then, that was in 2008. In 2010, they had a special GAN that went up to Darwin.
Yes.
Took an extra day.
Yeah.
And Don, actually, my son, he worked for Serco, who run the Great Southern Railways, and they asked him to be in charge of the train. I initially wasn't to be on it, and Murray Willing from Ardrossan was going to be the one, but he wasn't well, and that was covered by Landline, that trip.
Right.
So I was featured on Landline.
On the ABC.
ABC.
Yeah.
That's the only day I've missed Anzac Day, and I marched in Alice Springs.
Yeah.
Then when we got to Catherine, everyone got put on a bus to go to the falls, but that wasn't good enough for Bill. I had a helicopter. So it's all, you know, all in the adventurous life of going a heli. It's an odd feeling. I don't know whether you've been in one. It's not like being in an aeroplane, is it? It's different.
And you were for 5 years president of the 2nd Infantry Battalion Association, is that
right? Yeah, that's right. Mm. Well, I was always, connected with that and the Ratchet the Brook Association.
That's the Tobruk Association, yeah, okay.
Rather than the RSL. I've always been a member of the RSL, but in the RSL there wasn't the same feeling as in my unit thing, because we were all there.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you've got to realise in the army it takes about 7 men to keep one person in the front line.
Exactly.
So you don't have much connection with all these other fellas, you see, nothing in common. Anyway, that was in 2008. In 2012, they went back 70 years of they had a service back in Egypt, at Alamein, and I was selected to go back to there. So in my 90s, I had 2 overseas trips. That Darwin trip on the train, I've been flown up to Brisbane to turnouts. I've been flown to Sydney. I've been flown to Canberra. Last year I went to Canberra. Last year I was 98 when I went there. So, but in between, I haven't been sitting on the tail because I've been to schools and different organisations that I get invited to, you know, to speak.
I just want to take you back to that trip back to North Africa. Your sentiments then, your feelings and sensations when you saw the place again. What was it like? What was the experience like? What was the comparison?
Well, it hadn't changed very much. Still. They hadn't been, I think they wanted to go back to Tobruk, but of course Libya was a bit out of bounds in that time. Wasn't very stable in Egypt at that time either. There was 17 of us selected to go back there. It would be probably a bit more difficult to get a group of 17 together now of old fellows from there.
But because of all this and your many activities and the recognition you got, you were awarded another medal. Order of Australia.
Mm. Pretty great honour, really.
It's a tremendous thing.
I didn't know anything about it.
You just got the letter and it was a great surprise.
Well, just before, I think somebody said something about I'd been recommended for it. But of course, in all my activities, I have never pushed myself into it. I have been asked to take part. There's quite a bit of difference, I think.
I've seen you at ceremonies, I've seen you with state governors, and you have a great rapport with people at that level. I've noticed you were involved with the tree planting, the opening of the Memorial Walk, Kintore Avenue in Adelaide. You mix very easily and very comfortably with people like that.
Doesn't make any difference to me whether it's the Governor General or a person walking along the street.
Mm.
I've always liked people.
Yes.
I don't see all the dark side of people. I suppose I mightn't have had contact very much with them, but I've always mixed. I think that's the country way, you know.
Sure.
Most country people are pretty friendly type of people.
We didn't talk very much about your family. Maybe you just talk about them a little time. We talked about Don.
Yes. Well, Diane was a teacher, and she got posted out to the country.
Yeah.
She spent the next 33 years of her life there.
Right.
Her husband had a stroke at 51.
Yeah.
He was umpiring a children's football match when he collapsed.
Yeah.
This is up at Quorn. And he really, it was a bad stroke. But anyway, Diane sold, they had a farm at that time. They had a farm and they also had a property, a sheep property between Quorn and Hawker, but she sold out. She thought that was the best way to go, and she's come down to town. And her children, the boys both came to school down in town. They boarded at Emmanuel, and Julia at Seymour. So they all had schooling down here in Adelaide. Michael, the eldest boy, he's a farmer at Melrose.
Yes.
He actually won a scholarship with the South Australian Cricket Association, but he couldn't take it up because he was boarding at Roseworthy and he couldn't get there. The town, so he might have been a cricketer. He's a big, big, strong lad. I could see him knocking these sixes in these 20 over games.
So Don and Diane.
Yeah.
And several grandchildren.
Yeah. Well, to make my family a bit international again, Don and his wife, they adopted two girls, both from Korea, at 4 months old, at different, there's about 4 years difference in their age, and because they're 30 and so now, all the children, that Lee is a physiotherapist.
She's one of the grandchildren?
Well, yes, she's the eldest of Don's two girls. She has a degree in nuclear medicine as well as physio. She's got two master's degrees in the... she's just completed last year a master's degree in sports physio.
Yeah.
The younger one was... she's married and lives in Melbourne, but she had an art degree.
Diane's daughter has a master's degree in business management. She lives in Adelaide. She's not married. She hasn't met the right one. Michael's a farmer, and Matthew lives at Quorn, and he is the one that's got the great-grandchildren.
Yep.
And he at the moment is, he flies up to Onslow where they're building a oil plant, oil and gas plant.
So let's count them up. You've got five grandchildren, is it right? Five.
Mm-hmm.
And then two or three great-grandchildren?
Yeah, four.
Four great-grandchildren.
Four, yeah.
All right, terrific.
Yeah, twins.
I bet they love you.
Yeah. Oh, they do. Yeah. And I love them. Yeah. You know, children are wonderful.
Yeah, sure. Can I, again, let's just go back a bit. 61 years married to Iris.
Yeah.
May I ask how old she was when she died?
She was 7 years younger than me,
right.
So
okay.
I'll let you work up on that.
So what year was that, Bill? 2000, no, a bit later.
2000.
You got married in 1946.
Yeah. 60 years.
So, 61 years, 2007.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. Mm.
And so... we'll work that one out, shall we?
Well, she was a very quiet lady. What I would call a lady, but of course that's how people were brought up back in those days.
Yeah.
You know? She has two, or in her family, two pioneer people in her family. But they were all on her mother's side.
Right.
They were Scottish, yeah.
Because we'd established that your ancestry goes right back to the 1830s.
That's right. Right. Mm. Well, that's why the country.
Mm.
I always say, people say, oh, you don't look your age, or you don't carry on like your age. Yeah. When I was in my 80s to 90, I used to think I was about 50.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I used to say, well, I've got a little country boy inside of me. He won't let me get old.
That's most apparent. And I just, for people listening to the interview, I just have to say that sitting here with Bill, he's alert. He's the way you spring up out of a chair to go and get something is quite remarkable. But you do have an eyesight problem.
Yes.
Can you just talk about that a bit?
I have macular degeneration.
Yeah.
And I, unfortunately, it's very difficult for me to read anything. I almost say that I can't read, but I can if I've got to read something under that, my electronic reader, I can read that. It's frustrating.
Yep.
But it doesn't stop me. I can get around.
Yep.
And I've always been thankful for what I've got, rather than wish I had this and wish I had something else. So I think that's helped me a lot with this macular business, that I haven't let it get me down. I do get frustrated sometimes, but I don't get depressed.
No. I've noticed, again, people listening to the interview, the way that you spring up out of the chair, you go outside, you get something, you find everything, you know exactly where you are.
Mm.
But I guess there are other frustrations because it must be difficult to watch television, for example.
Well, it is. Football and cricket I can see. But I can't follow stories or anything because I can't follow the people that recognise the people.
Yeah.
You see, that's one of the things you can't recognise. I can see you sitting there quite plainly, but I can't see your face. Some people think that's all right.
Yeah.
So I tell all the girls, they all look beautiful. Because
so you've maintained a number of military facets in your life. I notice how impeccably pressed pants, yeah. polished shoes, yeah. clean shaven. Yeah. That's a routine you practice to this day.
Well, I've never grown a beard because I've never felt old enough to grow a beard. And I've got plenty of hair. I've had a haircut today. Yeah. I've had a haircut this morning and I did my washing this morning. So I haven't been sitting down. It's hot.
Exactly.
Day, but I that heart attack that I had Christmas time took a lot out of me. I'm not quite the same.
So that was last Christmas, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Christmas week
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
Mm.
I didn't know that it happened. I really didn't.
No, well, I sort of surprised them a bit, I think, how I got up. I used to walk around the ward and they could, you know, they seemed to think I was a bit different.
All right. And it's under control now.
But, yeah. yes, well, the medication. They didn't operate because I was too old to operate. And they didn't have records of what a 99-year-old would, you know,
yeah, sure.
how it would respond. So the medication is working.
You're coming up to the century. And you're going to raise your cap and wave your bat to all the millions out there who appreciate what you've done for our society. Bill, how do you want to celebrate your 100th birthday?
Well, I think, well, I've got to live to the 100 for all the people that want to celebrate, not me, but the others.
Yep.
Everybody wants to be... Oh, don't forget, I'll be part of it. So, I just go along. I'll tell you what I do, though. I cannot do work. The garden is, I used to have a garden, very nice, but it's slipped. And I just can't do it. I get puffed out. I've got to sit down if I do. Anything physical. I'm quite good sitting around. I hate just sitting around, but unfortunately, that's what I've got to do. But I can still go to schools.
Yep.
I've got a couple coming up that I'll be going to, and with Anzac Day coming, and probably someone else wants me.
Yes, you mentioned that you've only missed one Anzac Day in Adelaide since the war, is that right?
That's right, and I've always marched.
Always marched?
Yeah, but I'll be marching in a Jeep this year.
But you marched last year when you turned 98, didn't you? Is that right?
Yes, what I did was Don pushed me in one of those chairs, but I got off.
Yeah.
Before I got to the dais and I walked past, and then I wasn't going to get pushed past there.
Past the governor.
So
your thoughts then, you've missed only that one occasion, that one march, and that was when you were on a trip somewhere, you told me.
Yes, to Darwin.
Darwin. And you're going to be with us again Anzac Day this year at the age of 99. Now, and you'll be in the Jeep this year.
Yeah.
Looking back on it all, war, was it worth it? How did it change you? What are your sentiments? What do you think about that incredibly colourful, yet dangerous, fraught with danger, 5.5 years of military service? What are your sentiments when you reflect on that?
Well, I think anyone that served in the services probably remembers. You remember the good things, you know.
Yeah.
I had leave over in the Middle East, in Palestine. I saw all the biblical places that I'd learnt about in Sunday school. And I had 7 days leave at Cairo just before we came home. I was only back in Palestine 2 days when we were off to Australia. So I was lucky to get that 7-day trip in there. Oh, life's been very good to me. But I think anyone that's been in the services, I would like to see national service. I think the cost of national service would be overcome by the fact that so many of those fellows, that young people that got called up, would come out of it different people to when they went in. And I'm talking about people that haven't got much hope in life. They would put them in the same clothes as everyone else, and they discover that, oh gee, I'm as good as that chap, or I can do that. But they've never had a chance. And I think the savings of a lot of crime, and that would probably be helped by the national service.
So what do you tell children you go to these school visits to this day? What do you tell children when you go to those places?
Oh, I don't tell them. I only tell them stories about the war. Not about the actual war, you know, because I can go for ages and different chaps, different stories. And one thing, you know, I've spoken to full houses. I've spoken twice at St. Xavier's Cathedral. It's been full on pre-Anzac Day. I'm not a Catholic, but I've been invited to talk there. I was invited to come back because they reckon I was successful. I've never had notes, never. Even when I could read, I couldn't read now. But even when I could read, I never had notes. I just talk. And I never have failed to think of something, because one thing, when you've had all these experiences, it's not as though you're making something up. They just flow, one thing leads on to another. I've never been caught with... I spoke at the Army Navy Club one night at a dinner there, and I was supposed to have spoken for 10 minutes. Three quarters of an hour later, the president had to call an end to the thing. It wasn't caused by me speaking, but people kept asking questions. And they kept on, and the president said, well, he said, I've heard different people speak, but he said, in that three quarters of an hour, he said, you never said once, and when they ask a question, you straight away gave an answer, and you never had to pause to think of something. So, I don't know, it just seems to come out.
It's been a great honour talking to you for this interview. You have had an extraordinary life.
Yes, it has been. And you don't know what's in life, do you? You see, today, I think the difference today to back in my time, people think of careers today. People never used to think much of careers, only if you was born into a career family, you would probably be. But I was born in the country, and they never thought of careers. All I thought of was work.
Well, it's got you through, Bill. Bill Corey, soldier, yachtsman, family man.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Corey, OAM, association president. Great honour speaking to you. Thank you so much for your company and your wonderful memories in these interviews.
Thanks very much. I've always been a quiet person, that's the thing. But I feel a bit of a duty to me to talk about these things, because I'm a link with the past.